the inside is right. It's time to be stirred. The time is now. The winds have changed. Read the signs. No time to hide. The winds have changed.
Millennia ago, from the little cave on the tiny island of Patmos in the Aegean Sea, the heavens opened. Since then, the world has been fascinated by the cosmic upheaval brewing on the horizon of history. The upheaval is now upon us. It is within us. To some degree, it always has been. But there has been a sudden and violent shift in the affairs of the world. The winds have changed. Heaven will not be silent. Let's now join Father Anthony Bush, pastor of St. Stanislaus Kostka, the Sanctuary of the Divine Mercy in Chicago, and author of A Mother's Plea, For the Winds Have Changed. Together we can pave the way for a hopeful response to the signs of our times.
And good Monday afternoon. This is Mary Helen Fiorito. I am the Cardinal Francis George Fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C., and the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And it is my privilege to join you, as I do on most Mondays, filling in for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. I hope you Chicagoans enjoyed that miraculously beautiful weather that we had over the weekend, and we'll get one more day of it today before it all goes south again and hits the 90s and humidity and all that. But hope you had a beautiful weekend with your families. I know I did. We have a very, very packed show today. Lots going on, including the Supreme Court's decision this morning on transgender and gay rights and private employers. But we will get to that a little bit later in the show. Right now, I am pleased to be joined on the line by Carter Sneed, who is a professor of law at the University of Notre Dame's Law School and also the director for the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture. He has a great opportunity. We're going to discuss this morning the coveted spots at the DeNicola Center's annual Vitae Institute will now be available online. Because of COVID, obviously, it can't be held in person. So we have a big silver lining to that cloud. And Professor Sneed, welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It's great to join you, Mary.
Great to be with you. I know it's a busy week with the Vitae Institute going underway today. And why don't you tell for our listeners who aren't familiar with it, what is the Vitae Institute?
Yeah, so the Vitae Institute is our program. It's an intellectual formation program that we created here at the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture at the University of Notre Dame. And its purpose is to serve basically as an intellectual boot camp for leaders of the pro-life movement from around the world. For a week every summer, we bring people from really all over the place, to leaders of the pro-life movement, advocates, lawyers, some physicians, people working in maternal group homes, or people who run post-abortion healing ministries, or crisis pregnancy centers, or grassroots advocates of all kinds from all over the world, join us for a week where we take them through, in a pretty systematic way, a series of lectures and discussions on the subject matter that are most relevant to building a culture of life. So things like embryology, we have a series of lectures on biology, the biosciences, embryology. We have a day on law. We have a day on social science. We have a day on theology. We have a day on philosophy. And so it's a kind of intensive, compressed mini course in all the subjects that are relevant to honing their intellectual skills to be the most effective they can be in their work. But in addition to the classroom instruction and discussion, it's a great opportunity for leaders of the pro-life movement from around the world to meet each other and mm-hmm. to see where they might collaborate and become friends. And it's and so now we've got a we do it, as I said, for a week on campus every summer, but we've also been doing some mini satellite versions, one-day versions, at the invitation of different folks. We did one for Cardinal Dolan out in New York City. We did one for Cardinal DiNardo in Houston. We did one for Archbishop Gomez in Los Angeles. And so we've our network of alums, it's almost 500 or 600 alums who have gone through the program in one form or another. And these are people that have found projects to work on, you know, people from Africa, people from Europe, Latin America, all over the United States. It's just a great gathering place for leaders of the pro-life movement to learn and to get to know each other.
Yeah, and I, you know, having participated in the program a few years ago myself, you know, what I always tell people is there's something for everyone, from pro-life newbies to people who have been working in the movement for a number of years. You know, because there are so many, as you point out, aspects to the movement. There's the science part. There's the, you know, if you're a Catholic or a Christian, you're arguing the issue from a theological viewpoint. There's that piece of it. There's, you know, something for secular humanists. There's something, obviously, lots in the law to discuss. And I love that, the program is so comprehensive, but also, B, as you point out, those opportunities for networking, which are really invaluable. And, you know, the movement is so big and so diverse, even if you've been working in it for a good number of years or decades, as I have, there's still always people whose work you admire you've never met. And that's why what I love about Vita is that it brings together all of those people. And I can't tell you, there's not a year that goes by since you've started it that I don't get a call from somebody. You know, being from Chicago, we always, you know, you always say something like, well, I know a guy. I know somebody who knows somebody, right? So everybody I know knows I know you. And so I get a call, you know, I didn't get into Vita, or I got waitlisted. How can you help me get in? Can you put in a good word for me? Can I use you as a reference? But this year, this is terrific because it's really available for pretty much everybody who wants to sign up, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. No, we basically stretched over 5 days what we sometimes do in the one-day session. So we've got 5 lectures covering science, philosophy, law, sort of social science, feminism, and theology. And everybody who wants to can participate. We've got the webinar. People can participate by registering for the webinar on our website at ethicscenter.nd.edu. And we're also going to have a Facebook and YouTube platform as well for those folks, because we have a 500-person limit on who can participate in the webinar at any given time. You can register, and we can register more than 500 people, but when the webinar starts, after 500 people, after that limit's reached, then folks are going to have to go to YouTube and Facebook, but that's not hard to do, and there are instructions to do that on our website.
Right, and they won't be on all day. They won't be on all day. They just,
right.
It's just so that really makes it a little more manageable for people who, you know, have kids to care for, who have other jobs. And it's, I wasn't even aware of this, really, until kind of early last week that this opportunity was going to be available, and people seem really interested and excited. Could you tell us a little bit about the people who will be presenting?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we have a wonderful faculty, and we're sorry that not everybody who participates in our faculty for Vita is able to be showcased this week, but just in the interest of time, like you said, people don't have time to watch a computer screen for 8 hours a day, 10 hours a day. So we basically chose 5 lectures to be representative. The first lecture is going to be Father Nick Ostriaco, who is an extraordinary person. He's a Dominican priest who teaches at Providence College. He has multiple PhDs. He has a PhD in molecular biology from MIT and a PhD in moral theology from Freiburg. And I'm told he recently got an MBA as well, so there's pretty much nothing that he hasn't done. I mean, I guess he's going to go to law school next. But he's done an extraordinary amount of scholarly learning, and he will make apparent to the audience the basic embryological facts of human development that show that, you know, that's what you would find in any basic embryology textbook, which is that the life of the human organism begins at fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
That is, at sperm-egg fusion. From sperm egg fusion emerges a new, distinct, self-directing, living human being. And all of our lives, no matter who we are, began in that moment. And it shows that if you're going to pick and choose who counts and who doesn't by virtue of where you fall in the developmental spectrum of biological development, you're engaging in a kind of invidious discrimination, which leads us to our second lecture, which is a philosophical lecture. The first lecture is When Does Life Begin? Nick Ostriaco. Second lecture by a wonderful philosopher from Baylor named Frank Beckwith. Frank has written broadly about the life issues and he's a very careful and thoughtful guy. And he's going to lay out the philosophical case. That is to say, on day one, we'll learn when life begins as a biological matter. And on day two, we'll learn from Frank Beckwith why it's the case that none of the arguments trying to justify abortion by virtue either by trying to claim that the unborn child is not a person or by making a claim the unique burdens of pregnancy create a license to kill the unborn child, why all those arguments fail and shows their internal inconsistencies, and will show the fundamental argument, pro-life argument, grounded in a rich philosophical tradition. On the third day, I will be speaking about the law and public policy of abortion. I'll give a long overview of the history of abortion law in America, beginning with Roe v. Wade and coming up all the way to the present day, which is essential for understanding what, you know, because the law of abortion in America is entirely a creature of Supreme Court precedent, and which is surprising to a lot of people, that the Supreme Court in 1973 thought or determined that or read into the 14th Amendment, which was adopted in 1868, in part to and as a response to the grave wickedness and injustice of slavery, they read into the provisions of the 14th Amendment a right to abortion at a time when nobody believed that provision had anything to do with abortion, right? You had Ohio, the state of Ohio, ratify a state law the month after they ratified the 14th Amendment, banning abortion from conception, and nobody thought that they had done anything consistent by ratifying the 4th Amendment and then criminalizing abortion from conception. So I'll give the overview of the really the grave injustice and the corruption of the rule of law that's at the heart of abortion jurisprudence in America.
And the tremendous inconsistency, right? It's you know, it's always amazing to me where the unborn are protected under certain aspects of the law in the United States, except for abortion. It's always the except for abortion card. And I remember being present for your lecture the year I attended, and listeners, it's well worth your time, even if you think you know Roe and Doe and Casey and all the other abortion jurisprudence well. Professor Sneed really lays out a terrific timeline, but with a lot of different explanations you may not have heard. So thanks for letting me interject that, Professor, because I want to emphasize. And after you, who's next?
We start with science. We move on to philosophy. We apply it directly, concretely in the law in my lecture. And then on the fourth day, on Thursday, we're going to hear from Jeff Keating, who works an important program of the McGrath Institute for Church Life at Notre Dame, where she focuses on pro-life work and human dignity, and especially helping high schools to integrate, Catholic high school to integrate pro-life concepts into their curricula. She's an amazing person. She's finishing her PhD right now in systematic theology, and she's going to give an overview of the history of feminism and abortion and show, you know, how the early American feminists, especially the suffragettes, many, including the most prominent ones, were pro-life, and how the right to abortion, understood through the most rich tradition of feminism, shows that it's just a kind of another form, another tool of exploitation and abuse of women by men, and it's a very compelling talk, very rich, historically interesting and nuanced. And she's going to because, of course, in our contemporary discourse, you know, the simple and the sort of simplistic claim is like, oh, if you're a feminist, you have to be in favor of abortion. And Jess shows that that's in fact the opposite's true. That the richest understanding of feminism, rightly understood, leads one to a pro-life position. And then the last lecture will be, we'll hear from Father John Paul Kimes, who is, until very recently, he was a senior official at the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith in Rome, where he spent 10 and a half years as a canon lawyer in their discipline section in Rome. And he's been a fellow of the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture for several years. He was our canon law fellow, Raymond of Peñafort canon law fellow. And then this past year, we were fortunate enough to hire him permanently in residence at the University of Notre Dame in South Bend as a associate professor of the practice at the law school. So he is joining me on the faculty of the law school at Notre Dame, which is my primary appointment. I'm a law professor, in addition to being the director of the De Nicola Center. And he's joining our faculty as a law professor. And he will give a really extraordinary lecture to close it all out, situating the question of abortion within the larger critique that Pope Francis has made of contemporary culture, about that is to say the throwaway culture, to show how, you know, that the pro-life concept, the principles and goods at the core of the culture of life, the principles of radical hospitality and solidarity and justice and human dignity, are generative of commitments to caring for people in other contexts, in the context of immigration, in the context of racial unrest, as we're seeing right now. If there's something important, there's obviously a natural affinity between those who focus on a culture of life and fighting discrimination in all of its invidious forms, including racial discrimination, care for refugees, care for the disabled. It's just a broad, to kind of wrap up the whole week, he's going to synthesize the question of life and show how a culture of life is capacious and generative of commitments to other goods that we as Catholics take very seriously, and what John Paul II talked about as building a robust culture of life, and which Pope Francis talks about in terms of resisting the throwaway culture.
Excellent. I mean, I just the lineup of names alone, you know, is incredibly, impressive. And the fact that, you know, so many people, again, can join in and do this free of charge and do it from the comfort of your own home. It's really, I'm so grateful for the center for making this available. I was worried it would just be canceled for this year. And I'm so glad that you've taken, you know, the initiative to make it available to so many people who, you know, again, I know dozens just off the top of my head who have always wanted to attend, but for whatever reason, either didn't get in that year or, you know, just for family reasons couldn't join you. So it's marvelous. Where can people sign up? I know you mentioned it begins today. So can people,
go to our website. If you go to our website at Ethics Center, all one word, ethicscenter.nd.edu, on the very homepage, you'll immediately see the link for registration. You can click on the link, register. You'll receive an email notification telling you that you registered and giving you instructions and the password. There's a password to get in. If by some reason someone registers and they try to sign in at when it begins this evening and they're not able to do so, they can always go to the YouTube or Facebook platforms and watch the whole proceeding from there.
Okay, that's wonderful.
Yeah. So Mary, thanks. We really appreciate the opportunity to let your listeners know about this. And it's also important for your listeners to hear that we believe at the DeNicola Center for Ethics and Culture that it's really important that the University of Notre Dame is the home of the Vita Institute, because it is the Blessed Mother's University, and it is the case that the university has committed itself institutionally to building a culture of life and to bearing witness and being a prophetic voice for a culture of life in the public square and in academia.
Yeah, and under Our Lady's patronage, I know you've done such good things with Vita, but also with so many of your other programs. And I thank you for that. I know they're very important to our listeners. And listeners, I'll also post the links that Professor Sneed mentioned on my Facebook page and on my Twitter feed, so that if you didn't have a pencil with you in the car, you didn't get that down, you'll be able to go back and access it. Professor Sneed, thanks so much for joining us today, and good luck with the event.
Thank you so much, Mary. We're so delighted to have you as a fellow of the DeNicola Center, and we appreciate all the work that you do.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day, and God bless.
You too. Bye.
Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststanschurch.org. That's ststanschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located 2 blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway. During this COVID-19 virus pandemic, offering you prayer and inspiration through your faith.
The winds of change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Here's some welcome news. Father Anthony is reopening St. Stanislaus Kostka for the worship of Almighty God. St. Stan's will be limited to 150 people at any given time, and you must register to attend Mass. Because there's a lot of information that you'll need to have, we recommend that you visit ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. You can also register to attend Mass at St. Stan's by calling the parish office at 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
I think it's time to get some
lunch. Lunch. It's time for lunch. Lunch.
Yes, there is a free lunch. You can find chicken tenders, mac and cheese, pizza, pancakes, and more for children under 18 years of age in each household, available for grab-and-go curbside pickup Monday through Friday from 11 a.m. until 1:30 p.m. at Holy Trinity High School, 1443 West Division. The children don't have to be Holy Trinity students. Holy Trinity High School has partnered with Country House on the ISBE Summer Food Service Program. Enjoy Country House's signature made from scratch cooking and fun snack packs to brighten your summer. To find out more about the free lunch at Holy Trinity High School, call 708-389-4618. That's 708-389-4618. Come and enjoy meals every day.
Let's eat!
Anybody got an extra spork? I lost mine.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito. I am sitting in today here for Father Anthony on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ. And thank you for staying with us through the hour. About 9 o'clock this morning, my cell phone started exploding with pings, which is generally never a good sign. And I looked down to see that the Supreme Court this morning had released its opinion in a somewhat hotly followed and contested case that involves both rights of homosexuals and those who identify as transgender. The case is Bostock versus Clayton County, Georgia. And if you have been on Twitter or Facebook or any other social media platform in the last hour, it has already exploded with what you would expect it would explode with. And I'm so grateful that today's guest is an expert in issues surrounding not only constitutional law, but also religious liberty cases. And that's attorney Eric Niffen, who is at the firm, Professor Lewis Rocca, Rothenberger Christie, and was formerly a trial attorney for the Department of Justice, the DOJ, and was also legal counsel for the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty in Washington, D.C., where he represented clients in litigation at trial and in the federal appellate court. So, tremendous expert. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Niffen. It's an honor to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Good to be with you.
So did your phone explode as well?
It did.
If mine did, I can't imagine.
Media, email.
Yeah, what have you hit into opportunity? I know I'm trying to work my way through the opinion as I was driving downtown. My husband drove me so I could read as we were driving. So I don't want listeners to think that I was breaking the law there. But I'm still not all the way through it. But I'm finding the language a little bit confusing in a number of different places in the opinion. I haven't gotten to the dissents yet. Can you give us, first of all, an overview of the facts of the case?
Sure. This is several different cases that have been consolidated here, but the main facts are simple, and the court sums them up very simply. So here you have people who were there's no question as to their general competence within the job. There's no question that they were fired for any other reason, that at some point after hire, the employer learned about their either sexual orientation or their gender identity and determined that it was unacceptable or impossible to hire them.
And these were private employers, correct? Not religious entities.
Correct.
So in both cases, we have, I think one's a funeral home.
One was arguably a religious entity, but it did not bring those religious liberty claims up to the Supreme Court.
And I see.
So that wasn't an issue here.
Okay. Okay. So you have, I think in one case, a homosexual man, and then in another case, someone who I believe when they were hired was male, but then at some point informed the employer that they were transitioning to become a female. Is that correct?
Yeah, and that last one is the one where there was a religious liberty angle. I think
right.
There's also I think perhaps the one in which the employer situation is the most sympathetic. So here you have an employer, I believe in Indiana, who runs a funeral home, and the employee in question was helping sort of care for and greet people, a family member who was sick coming to a funeral. And this man said, look, I know my community. I've been serving here for a long time. And, you know, as sympathetic as I may be to this individual who now wants to present as female, I just can't see putting that on my customers, my guests, as they're coming in here to grieve a loved one. That just seems like too much to ask of them in this situation. That was the way he presented his decision.
Because it was like a small community, and as you mentioned, you know, he knew his employee well. The employee was sort of known in the community, and I believe the funeral home felt that, you know, it would be too sort of jarring for people who are already in an emotionally distraught situation to have to interact in that way, because it was a home run by a funeral home that obviously people with strong religious convictions would patronize because of the family who owned it. That's my understanding.
That's right.
Okay.
And that's something that I think is sympathetic at a human level, but is something that our law generally does not want to take into consideration. Just gets too complicated and says, nope, sorry, the rule is the rule. And that's the way that came out here.
Right. And so, you know, as I'm looking through the decision, you know, one of the interesting things, the foci, if you will, is that the court really does focus on the word sex. And they make a notation that homosexuality and transgender status are inextricably bound up with sex. But then later in the opinion, they go on, I mean, not quite contradict themselves, but they offer some sort of puzzling, I don't know, almost counter language saying, we realize homosexual orientation and transgender, you know, transitioning, if you will, are not exactly under the definition of sex itself. So they seem almost to contradict themselves even within their own opinion.
Yeah, that, Justice Alito, I thought, had the better of this in his dissent. And so he picks on the majority opinion, which jumps on this hypothetical. It's saying, okay, you're at a holiday party, and the boss is introduced to the employee introduces
her wife,
the employee's spouse.
Right.
And whether or not the employer is shocked and makes an employment decision is simply based on the sex of that employee. So we know that this employee has a female spouse.
Right.
And so that is the way that these have been characterized, to sort of say, look, male employees can have a female spouse, but a female employee cannot have a female spouse. And therefore, it is sex discrimination. Justice Alito presents another way to see that. And here, he quotes the testimony at oral argument of one of the attorneys representing one of the either homosexual or transgender people. I can't remember which. But and that attorney admitted that if there was a simple policy that the employer had that said, if you are either homosexual or transgender, you may not be employed here. And that rule was applied across the board and was applied to an employee that could be applied to an employee without even knowing that employee's sex.
Mm-hmm.
And in that case, the attorney admitted, yes, that would not be discrimination on the basis of sex. And Justice Alito used that to say it is not true. And the court had an admission that it is not true that discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation always is discrimination based on sex.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Justice Alito said that under the court's precedent, discrimination against someone who is in a same-sex relationship could be a sex stereotype case that could win under Price Waterhouse and some of the other the court's precedents,
mm-hmm.
but not necessarily. And that not necessarily was a key part of his argument, whereas the majority had to argue very hard that this is axiomatic and it's always the case and it's just based on language.
Right, yeah. And it seems to, as I'm reading it, and again, I've not read all of the dissents yet, and so I haven't read what Justice Alito had to say, but it seems to take what Title VII said and sort of superimpose it on cases that weren't being considered and wouldn't even have, I think, entered anyone's minds at the time Title VII was written.
Right. And so the majority does not disagree. What it tries to do is sidestep all of that by saying where the text is absolutely, absolutely clear, you don't even have to look at the history or the context. And that's why they argue so hard that the language is absolutely clear. So all these other considerations, what did EEOC, how did it interpret Title VII, how did courts interpret Title VII, what did Congress think, what did other federal agencies who use this phrase on the basis of sex think for 1920 through 1964 on past that? None of that matters because the majority says the text is clear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is where I'm kind of getting concerned about the way in which this ruling might be extrapolated into areas where I don't think the court intends it to go. And, I was thinking back today, gosh, this has to be 20 years ago, when Massachusetts was considering changing its laws on marriage and redefining marriage to include two people of the same sex. And there was a woman, I think it was still called the McNeil-Lear News Hour at that time, and now it's just the PBS News Hour, who said, listen, nothing in your, she was a gay woman who had had the same partner for many years, nothing in your life will change if this law changes. Nothing in your life changes. Everything is the same. My life will change because I'll be able to visit my partner if she's in the hospital. We'll have survivorship rights. You know, we'll both be listed as parents at my children's school, et cetera, et cetera. So she made some, as you would say, very heartfelt arguments about her and her partner being able to just function in society in the same way a married couple would function in society. And here we, and I remember at the time, more conservative writers saying, once you've opened this door, this really could mm-hmm. lead to other situations where, for example, religious institutions who believe that marriage is a covenant relationship between a man and a woman will be compelled to either perform them or not perform them for anyone. And now, mm-hmm. We're seeing this day kind of approach. Can you, I had a number of questions on my Facebook page this morning, Eric, about people concerned about the application of this to Catholic, to evangelical, Orthodox Jewish places of employment where, they're, for example, say an Orthodox Jewish deli, which would not be in and of itself a religious institution, but would be run in a way that very much reflected religious values. For example, keeping separate refrigerators and keeping kosher in the deli, what mm-hmm. they sell and don't mm-hmm. sell, et cetera, et cetera. Can you sort of speak to those kind of cases where it might not be a church, but there would be mm-hmm. more sort of, mm-hmm. Intentional religious private employers, if that makes sense?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that does make sense. You may have caught this, Mary, right at the end of the majority decision, Justice Gorsuch's opinion for the court says, look, there's a lot of amici that have written in about these religious liberty concerns, but that's not before the court, and those issues will have to be presented in another case. This case has nothing to say about that. The court says that sort of thing a lot, and it's silly. Of course, that's not true.
And I wish he had led with that rather than ending with it. I'm not sure I feel as confident about it being the final shot,
Everything's going to be fine. Right?
Yeah.
Those practical questions are very important. That's a big part of my practice, Mary, is helping religious institutions of all stripes understand where they sit under federal and state employment laws, public accommodation laws, and the broad struggle here is these are individuals, and whether they operate a church, whether they operate an apostolate, whether they operate a school, whether they operate a business, they are doing what they're doing because they've been called to it.
Right.
And part of that call is to do it in a particular way. So it's not just to have an organization, but it's to have an organization to operate it and consistent with how they believe they've been called by God to do so.
Right. So like for a Christian day camp or something like that for children.
Yes. And even a craft store like Hobby Lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And so then the question is, how is this going to work? And when the court makes a decision, as it does today, it puts a lot more pressure on these other parts of the law.
Mm-hmm.
So the parts of the law that say, well, what counts as a religious organization under Title VII? What do you have to do to be a religious organization? There's going to be more pressure on that. What does it mean when Title VII says that you can discriminate on the basis of religion if you are a religious organization?
Mm-hmm.
That there's more pressure on that.
Right.
There's another case that we're going to find out in the next week or two on another Monday in June about the ministerial exception.
Right.
And what is the new test that the court is going to propose in terms of what counts as a ministerial employee? That's really important because religious organizations have more leeway. They have more freedom from the government.
Mm-hmm.
When they employ religious ministerial employees, that is people who are entrusted to teach the faith and how to lead the organization, they have more freedom. So that's going to be more important going forward.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these things are important, and everything shifts when you have a decision like this that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's going to be something that I'm going to be working with clients on and talking to a lot of people, doing a lot of interviews.
Yeah,
in the
I
days
can
and
imagine.
Weeks to come.
Well, what's so if and then we'll go to our break, Eric. But how, if you could kind of sum this up in your elevator speech, how would you sum up today's ruling? Who will it affect, and how will it affect them?
Broadly speaking, I think it is a bad sign for our country that the Supreme Court has issued a decision that is based not on the text of a law, but it is another decision which the Supreme Court is looking to trends in culture and is deciding a decision based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a bad thing for all of us, that the balance of powers has been upset. More broadly, it means that religious organizations of all stripes, religious employers are going to have to revisit their own policies, revisit how they present themselves to the law, and what their employment rules and why they have those rules, in order to minimize their exposure to liability moving forward.
Okay. And just to clarify again, before we go to the break, this really applies to private employers at this juncture.
Yes.
Okay. Today's at least that's what they're saying, kind of. But I almost feel like there's a nod, wink, wink at the end of this thing. But maybe I'm reading it with a little more jaundiced eye than I should. But I understand. You know, I have been kind of scrolling through Twitter this morning, and you know, for many people who are gay or transgender, they feel it's, you know, a vindication of who they are as human beings, and in some way the government validating that they can't be discriminated against for who they really are. But which isn't in and of itself not a bad thing. You obviously don't want to hate someone just for you know, who they are, who they're identifying as. However, when you're getting into employment issues, the reach goes much further than just respecting another person's right to exist.
Yes. Another thing that we hadn't mentioned here, I think this decision and the trend we've been on for the past 15, 20 years is putting a lot of pressure on the church and Christians more broadly to really dig down deep and try to understand what it is about that we believe about human anthropology and human sexuality being a big part of that. And why, you know, so for 2,000 years, beliefs on marriage and sexuality really weren't challenged that much.
Mm-hmm.
But now they are. And we have to really do some serious thinking and examination and saying, why are these things important to us?
Right.
We first need to be able to convince Catholics that it's important.
Right.
That's a job that hasn't been successful so far. And maybe if we can get that done, then maybe we can have some success in explaining ourselves to the broader public.
Right.
That's
because,
a really important job.
Yeah, and I agree with you 100% on that. I think the catechesis, for the most part, on this issue has been abysmal. And you know, when I just try to explain, for example, the Baker case, the famous cake baker case from Colorado, you know, trying to explain to people that, you know, the only reason, and if I remember from my law school days correctly, that the government ever got involved with recognizing marriages in the first place was to legally bind men to the children that they fathered, men primarily, but women as well, to make sure that children who could result from a conjugal union would be protected. Mm-hmm. The government was not in the business of recognizing your romantic relationships. I mean, it's very nice that you have mm-hmm. them, but the government did not want to control who you love and how you love, and love is love, and And because marriage was different, because it was a conjugal union, which is why so many states had consummation laws, right? You could file, even under the civil law, you could file for civil annulment if your marriage hadn't been consummated within, I think, 6 months or so in most states. But when marriage was redefined simply to mean love and not to mean this particular conjugal relationship that could, not in every instance does it, but could, for the most part, result in new human life, we just threw open the doors to everything. And I was just saying to someone the other day, I simply don't know if there is a direct challenge to Obergefell on polygamy. I don't see how the court can say no to that under the thought, not only under Obergefell, but also under today's case.
Yeah, Senator Santorum, a lot of other people got really pilloried at the time by saying, you know, this decision has no bounds and this could happen, this could happen. Everyone sort of waved their hands and said, oh, come on, that's outrageous. But this whole line of cases does show the wisdom and I think the correctness in the church's teaching in this area, that once you separate out the procreation of children from sexuality, then what is left other than an emotional bond between two people?
Right.
And so once you start tinkering with these relationships and the natural consequences of a sexual union, it gets really hard to say, okay, well, if contraception is okay, then it makes it harder to explain why abortion is wrong. Because
right.
then you're sort of saying, well, there is a right to be able to, or a legitimate expectation in order to have intimacy without children. And then it gets down here to sexual, the importance of heterosexual versus homosexual relationships. And it's hard to explain really in the end why they're all that different.
Yeah.
So again, this gets back to the challenge to the court to look to its own traditions, look to its own teaching and see, is this something that we still believe is true? Can we explain it better in light of the challenges we're facing today? And what are we going to do about it?
Yeah, I think, you know, the book that Ryan Anderson did with Sharif Girgis and Robert George, you know, What is Marriage? I really think should be taught in every high school, every Catholic high school, because it does it without getting into, you know, how, of course, we treat every human being as a child of God, meriting dignity and respect. That's not even on the table. We're just talking about what a marriage is. And is a close bond between two men or two women a marriage? By definition, it really isn't, because it doesn't have that conjugal component. And why that conjugal, you know, why did people go on honeymoons, right? I mean, it's interesting, in canon law, I have a friend who's a canonist whose entire portfolio, her entire caseload, all she does is non-consummatum cases, which means the marriages were never, believe it or not, it's very sad, and she's seeing an increase in the number of cases that she does, largely because of porn, because men who become addicted to porn at a very young age are then, when they are actually married to a real woman, you know, unable to consummate the marriage physically. And so, you know, for a woman who wants to marry a man because she wants children, and then the man isn't able to consummate the marriage with her, becomes incredibly, you know, anyway, not to go into the weeds here, but is seeing the number of her non-consummatum filed cases increase. So, you know, that's sort of a natural result of it, too. But how the church has always looked at the very fact, if your marriage isn't consummated physically, then it's actually not a sacramental marriage. So, so it does go back into some kind of, deep, but I think easy to understand when they are explained correctly, philosophical and theological nuances, that I think you're absolutely so right. We haven't really articulated well to people generally. Well, we're over time. I'm being waved at here and told I've gone way over the time for our break. But if you can stay with us to the other end of the break, we'll get to some other cases, because initially you and I were going to talk about the Supreme Court's decision on public worship. And I would still like to touch on that with you, if you're okay with it. And wonderful.
Sure,
thanks so much for hanging through us to the break. Listeners, please don't go away. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony here on listener-supported Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Here's some welcome news. Father Anthony is reopening St. Stanislaus Kostka for the worship of Almighty God. St. Stan's will be limited to 150 people at any given time, and you must register to attend Mass. Because there's a lot of information that you'll need to have, We recommend that you visit ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. You can also register to attend Mass at St. Stan's by calling the parish office at 773-278-2470. That's 773-278-2470. St. Stan's is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
The Winds of Change. The Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ.
Because of the unprecedented COVID-19 virus pandemic, the Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's needs your immediate help. The Soup Kitchen is asking for your donations of water, juice boxes, individual food servings, hand sanitizers, and Lysol. The Providence Soup Kitchen at St. Stan's is operating regular hours during this pandemic. The Soup Kitchen is operated by the Daughters of St. Mary Providence from the basement of St. Stanislaus Kostka Church, which serves over 21,000 meals per year. To offer your help, please call Sister Darlene at 773-870-2435. That number again is 773-870-2435. Thank you. Here's some good news. We are pleased to announce that St. Stanislaus Kostka is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, in answer to our Blessed Mother's call to open the doors. The Blessed Sacrament will again be exposed all day, every day, except when Masses or other services are being held. You are invited to come and pray anytime, day or night. For your safety, we ask that you practice social distancing and wear a mask. Hand sanitizer is available, and St. Stan's has increased cleaning and sanitizing of the church, and a security person will be on site. More information can be found at ststandschurch.org. That's ststandschurch.org. St. Stanislaus Kostka is located two blocks north of Division on Noble, just off the Kennedy Expressway.
And welcome back. This is Mary Fiorito sitting in today for Father Anthony here on Winds of Change on AM 750 WNDZ in Chicago. And I am joined by constitutional law attorney and religious liberty specialist Eric Kniffen today. And we are talking about not only the Supreme Court's decision this morning in a case involving transgender and gay rights in the private workplace, but we're also going to touch on when I first contacted Mr. Kniffen to ask him to come on the show, I really wanted him to speak about the religious liberty issues at work and being discussed when most of the churches in the country remained closed for COVID. And the Supreme Court at the end of May handed down an interesting decision, again, very close, 5-4, with Justice Roberts going with the majority, South Bay United Pentecostal Church et al., versus Gavin Newsom, governor of the state of California. It was for injunctive relief, and so that churches could open. Interesting, brought by a Pentecostal church and not by a Catholic or another more well-known and established entity. Mr. Kniffen, can you tell us a little bit about that particular case? Were you surprised by the Supreme Court's decision?
Sure. So in that decision, this came up to the court looking for an emergency injunction. So it did not come up through the normal channel. Obviously, because this pandemic is brand new, and so something on that subject has to come to court really quickly. So the decision was 5-4 against granting this emergency injunction, and the lineup was Chief Justice Roberts and then the four liberal justices in denying the injunction, and with the four other conservative justices in the dissent. And the issue had to do with whether or not the rules against for churches reopening in California unfairly discriminated on the basis of religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issue comes down to how do you make comparisons? And this is a fun thing for lawyers to do, but it's something that other people can understand too. And so what is the best comparison? And so you have a variety of things to choose from. In Chief Justice Roberts' opinion, he said, look, the things that are most like church services are concerts and movie theaters and lecture halls and those sorts of things. And based on the record we have before us, based on what we can see right now, there is not enough evidence that says that the church services are being treated worse than those similar activities. Justice Kavanaugh wrote for the dissent, and he was making broader arguments saying, look at what California is doing towards retail stores, and look what they're doing towards these other entities. And he was making this broader sort of a moral argument that said, if these things can go forward, how come church services can't do too? And that argument makes sense.
Right.
But I do think that Roberts had the better sort of technical comparison, that the better comparison is to people sitting next to each other in rows of seats for a long period of time. And Chief Justice Roberts also pointed out, and this is something I appreciate him saying, is look, we're the Supreme Court. We do not want to be overriding policy decisions on matters of public health that state officials are making. We shouldn't be doing that unless it's just obvious that there's something wrong.
Right.
And so this has been one of the big concerns that those of us who care about the church and want to get back to church, we listen to public health experts, and they say that, look, walking by someone in the aisle is not the same thing as sitting next to someone for an hour in a big room, especially where you're singing and you know, you have other these sorts of things. People say that being indoor is different than being outdoor. Being someone momentarily is different by being next to someone for a long time. And based on all those sorts of considerations, Chief Justice Roberts said, look, it's not obvious that it is discriminating on the basis of religion to treat a church differently than a retail store.
Right, because the venue itself is different. That's the argument he's making.
Right, and again, as lawyers, although lawyers like to pretend to be experts in a wide range of things, we're not public health experts.
Right.
And so we ought to sort of defer there. And
right.
So I understand why that decision upset a lot of people, but I understood why it came out the way
yeah.
it did.
Well, you know, go ahead, I'm sorry, please.
But there are other situations which have been really, really obnoxious and which I'm glad have already been changed. And so right at the same time the Supreme Court's decision came out, there was another set of rules that was put out in Madison, Wisconsin.
Okay.
And what made that really important was that set of rules treated differently and treated better the very institutions that Chief Justice Roberts had said were the same as churches.
Hmm.
And so in Madison, I can't remember the name of the parish, but there's a parish in Madison that seats over 1,200 people.
Mm-hmm.
And so that parish could be filled to 25% capacity if it were to show a movie.
Okay.
But if it wanted to follow that movie with a mass,
mm-hmm.
all but 50 people had to leave.
Yeah.
And that isn't right.
Right, 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 right. That's absolute. That so a real discrimination against worship, but not against gathering.
Right. And
yeah.
so you take this category of gatherings where people sit down in chairs next to each other, and at the very least, those have to be treated the same.
Right.
And I'm very grateful that our friends at the Beckett Fund stepped in and were persuasive in helping the people of Madison, the government there, to see the error of their ways. And within a few days, they reversed course. So that's a good thing.
Right. Well, you know, I guess where I, you know, just to go back to the California case briefly, I certainly appreciate what Justice Kavanaugh had to say when he talks about the 25% occupancy cap, and he notes how they apply to factories and to restaurants and to, as you mentioned, retail stores. And, you know, he goes into a whole sort of litany, you know. And, of course, I think what's particularly galling, I think, for people in Illinois were that, you know, recreational marijuana, cannabis is now legal here. And the cannabis stores were, I mean, they were talking about how their businesses during the shutdown were doubling and almost tripling. And the cannabis stores
yeah.
could stay open and abortion clinics could stay open,
mm-hmm.
which I have mm-hmm. to say I find particularly appalling at a time when we're working so hard to save lives that abortion clinics were deemed, you know, necessary and kept open. And you know, I mean, if you've ever sort of seen the inside of a clinic, I mean, there's ample room for people to pass on COVID to each
mm-hmm.
other. And, you know, that was very, very discouraging. But in many Chicago area churches, I think the minimal probably seating capacity we have in one of our smaller churches would be 500 to 800. Our churches were built at a time where many, many, many people of different ethnic populations went to Mass. And so,
right.
you know, for a
mm-hmm.
church to see it, seat 1,000 people here is not unusual. And to have everyone there, say, unless they're a family of the same household, spaced, you know, 6 feet apart, doesn't pose, it probably poses less risk than some of the other, you know, places that Chief Justice Roberts cites. However, this is my, I guess, my little, you know, caveat there. I get very uncomfortable whether it's, you know, a conservative majority or a liberal majority saying to a particular church, this is how you can now operate your worship. I don't think that's, I don't want them coming near us. I would rather they stay far, far away and not dictate to us. Public health officials offering their opinion is one thing, but the court stepping in and saying, houses of worship, this is how you shall worship, I really think that crosses a line into interference in, because, you know, for many traditions, you know, praying in hands and all these other kinds of things where there's a little more physical intimacy are very common. And so I guess that would be sort of my level of discomfort. And I don't know if you would share that.
I do. I do. I'm with you. The things that concern me most about this episode and the rules against churches, first of all, churches being deemed non-essential. And I think sometimes this has been in the subtext. And then with Mayor de Blasio in New York City, he just came out and said it.
He just
said, look, all you religious people need to sort of chill out and realize that these protests are more important than what you guys do.
Go back and cling to your guns and religion in your home. Yeah, but don't come outside.
So you just have to take a back seat to that right now. And so he said explicitly what a lot of these rules have seemed to say implicitly, that you know, it's very important that alcoholics have access to alcohol in the middle of a public health emergency because we can't flood the emergency rooms. And that's understandable. Mm-hmm. So I get that. But whether it's important for people to receive the sacraments, whether it's people to meet corporately for worship, to worship the creator of the universe, that's somewhere down in the pecking order.
Right.
And that's hard to swallow. And so that part of it, the ranking of religion, and then also whether or not government or courts are going to get involved in telling people how to worship. The one set of rules I saw encouraged people to think of new and creative ways to have virtual communion services.
Right.
And whether or not that's a plausible idea for some religious traditions, it certainly isn't us as Catholics. And the very idea is it's shockingly ignorant and then offensive. And so government should not be in the business of ranking religion as less important than their activities and should not be telling religious organizations the proper way to conduct their own ritual.
Right, and their own services. And that's why, you know, I was so grateful to see the piece in the New York Times. I think you and I might have discussed this online by Senator Mitch McConnell, where he makes the argument, and I thought it was very good, that, listen, it doesn't matter what Governor Cuomo says, and it doesn't matter what Governor Pritzker here in Illinois says. The First Amendment has already decided that houses of worship and religion is essential. So you can't yeah. tell us in an order, you can't override that, no matter what your, you know, opinion on houses of worship are. You know, I saw there was a good meme floating around saying, you know, please try and remember your pastor has most likely never lived through a pandemic before. And really, if you're having regular worship in your church, good for you. But please do listen to whatever, you know, directives are given for you to participate in that worship, because, you know, I'm glad you trust in God and that you believe in him. But you know what? He is trying to protect you, and he may have legal liability issues you know nothing about. And I think this is another sort of sad, you know, commentary on our litigious society. But I think, you know, Catholic churches in particular need to be concerned about that. Do you have, was there anything any of your clients contacted? I know you can't say specifically, but were there any of your clients that contacted you with those kind of concerns?
With liability concerns, I think it's an important thing to keep in mind. But I think the risk is low there.
Right, yeah.
The idea that a court is going to say that a church was reckless in the way it conducted religious service, that it should have conducted its religious service in a different way,
right,
I think is unlikely.
Right. Well, Eric Niffen, thank you so much for joining us. What a joy to be with you. Listeners, if you'd like to learn more about Eric and his practice, you can either just Google his name or go to the law firm Lewis, Rocca, Rothenberg, and Christie. This was Mary Fiorito sitting in for Father Anthony today. on Winds of Change. Thank you and have a great week.
What's there to say when the world makes no sense? Do we search deeper truths or sit on the fence? Can you see? Can you see? Can you see the winds have changed? We marvel and flatter such meaningless thought. The shell appears strong, but the inside is rot. It's time to be stirred. The time.